Chapter 24. People were living somewhere, and real things happening to them. Dot, there they come, breathed the best man excitedly, but the bridegroom knew better. The cautious opening of the door of the church meant only that Mr. Brown, the livery stable keeper, gowned in black in his intermittent character of sexton, was taking a preliminary survey of the scene before marshalling his forces. The door was softly shut again, then after another interval it swung majestically open, and a murmur ran through the church. He family. Mrs. Welland came first, on the arm of her eldest son. Her large pink face was appropriately solemn, and her plum-colored satin with pale blue side panels, and blue ostrich plumes in a small satin bonnet, met with general approval. But before she had settled herself with a stately rustle in the pew opposite Mrs. Archer's, the spectators were craning their necks to see who was coming after her. Wild rumors had been abroad the day before to the effect that Mrs. Manson Mingott, in spite of her physical disabilities, had resolved on being present at the ceremony, and the idea was so much in keeping with her sporting character that bets ran high at the clubs as to her being able to walk up the nave and squeeze into a seat. It was known that S.E. had insisted on sending her own carpenter to look into the possibility of taking down the end panel of the front pew, and to measure the space between the seat and the front, but the result had been discouraging, and for one anxious day her family had watched her dallying with the plan of being wheeled up the nave in her enormous bath chair and sitting enthroned in it at the foot of the chancel. The idea of this monstrous exposure of her person was so painful to her relations that they could have covered with gold the ingenious person who suddenly discovered that the chair was too wide to pass between the iron uprights of the awning which extended from the church door to the curbstone. The idea of doing away with this awning and revealing the bride to the mob of dressmakers and newspaper reporters who stood outside fighting to get near the joints of the canvas exceeded even old Catherine's courage, though for a moment as he had weighed the possibility. Hi, they might take a photograph of my child and put it in the papers, Mrs. Welland exclaimed when her mother's last plan was hinted to her, and from this unthinkable indecency the clan recoiled with a collective shudder. The ancestress had had to give in, but her concession was bought only by the promise that the wedding-breakfast should take place under her roof, though, as the Washington Square connection said, with the Willands' house in easy reach it was hard to have to make a special price with Brown to drive one to the other end of nowhere. Though all these transactions had been widely reported by the Jacksons, a sporting minority still clung to the belief that old Catherine would appear in church, and there was a distinct lowering of the temperature when she was found to have been replaced by her daughter-in-law. Mrs. Lovell Mingott had the high color and glassy stare induced in ladies of her age and habit by the effort of getting into a new dress. But once the disappointment occasioned by her mother-in-law's non-appearance had subsided, it was agreed that her black chantilly over lilac satin, with a bonnet of parma violets, formed the happiest contrast to Mrs. Welland's blue and plum color. Far different was the impression produced by the gaunt and mincing lady who followed on Mr. Mingott's arm, in a wild dishevelment of stripes and fringes and floating scarves. And as this last apparition glided into view, Archer's heart contracted and stopped beating. He had taken it for granted that the Marchioness Manson was still in Washington, whereas he had gone some 4 weeks previously with her niece, Madame Olenska. It was generally understood that their abrupt departure was due to Madame Olenska's desire to remove her aunt from the baleful eloquence of Dr. Agathon Carver, who had nearly succeeded in enlisting her as a recruit for the Valley of Love, and in the circumstances no one had expected either of the ladies to return for the wedding. For a moment Archer stood with his eyes fixed on Medora's fantastic figure, straining to see who came behind her. But the little procession was at an end, for all the lesser members of the family had taken their seats, and the 8 tall ushers, gathering themselves together like birds or insects preparing for some migratory maneuver, were already slipping through the side doors into the lobby. "Newland, I say. She's here," the best man whispered. Archer roused himself with a start. A long time had apparently passed since his heart had stopped beating, for the white and rosy procession was in fact halfway up the nave. The bishop, the rector and two white-winged assistants were hovering about the flower-banked altar, and the first chords of the Spohr symphony were strewing their flower-like notes before the bride. Archer opened his eyes,
but could they really have been shut, as he imagined?
And felt his heart beginning to resume its usual task. The music, the scent of the lilies on the altar, the vision of the cloud of tow and orange blossoms floating nearer and nearer, the sight of Mrs. Archer's face suddenly convulsed with happy sobs, the low benedictory murmur of the rector's voice, the ordered evolutions of the 8 pink bridesmaids and the 8 black ushers. All these sights, sounds and sensations, so familiar in themselves, so unutterably strange and meaningless in his new relation to them, were confusedly mingled in his brain. "My God," he thought, "have I got the ring?" And once more he went through the bridegroom's convulsive gesture. Then, in a moment, May was beside him, such radiance streaming from her, that it sent a faint warmth through his numbness, and he straightened himself and smiled into her eyes. "Dearly beloved, we are gathered together here," the rector began. The ring was on her hand, the bishop's benediction had been given, the bridesmaids were poised to resume their place in the procession, and the organ was showing preliminary symptoms of breaking out into the Mendelssohn March, without which no newly wedded couple had ever emerged upon New York. "Your arm, I say, give her your arm," young Newland nervously hissed. And once more Archer became aware of having been adrift far off in the unknown. What was it that had sent him there, he wondered. Perhaps the glimpse, among the anonymous spectators in the transept, of a dark coil of hair under a hat which, a moment later, revealed itself as belonging to an unknown lady with a long nose, so laughably unlike the person whose images he had evoked, that he asked himself if he were becoming subject to hallucinations. And now he and his wife were pacing slowly down the nave, carried forward on the light Mendelssohn ripples, the spring day beckoning to them through widely open doors, and Mrs. Welland's chestnuts, with big white favors on their frontlets, curveting and showing off at the far end of the canvas tunnel. The footman, who had a still bigger white favor on his lapel, wrapped May's white cloak about her, and Archer jumped into the brougham at her side. She turned to him with a triumphant smile, and their hands clasped under her veil. "Darling," Archer said, and suddenly the same black abyss yawned before him, and he felt himself sinking into it, deeper and deeper, while his voice rambled on smoothly and cheerfully. "Yes, of course I thought I'd lost the ring. No wedding would be complete if the poor devil of a bridegroom didn't go through that. But you did keep me waiting, you know. I had time to think of every horror that might possibly happen." She surprised him by turning, in full Fifth Avenue, and flinging her arms about his neck. "But none ever can happen now, can it, Newland, as long as we two are together?" Every detail of the day had been so carefully thought out that the young couple, after the wedding breakfast, had ample time to put on their traveling clothes, descend the wide Mingott stairs between laughing bridesmaids and weeping parents, and get into the brougham under the traditional shower of rice and satin slippers. And there was still half an hour left in which to drive to the station, buy the last weeklies at the bookstall with the air of seasoned travelers, and settle themselves in the reserved compartment in which May's maid had already placed her dove-colored traveling cloak and glaringly new dressing back from London. The old Dulac aunts at Rinnebeck had put their house at the disposal of the bridal couple, with a readiness inspired by the prospect of spending a week in New York with Mrs. Archer, and Archer, glad to escape the usual bridal suite in a Philadelphia or Baltimore hotel, had accepted with an equal alacrity.
May was enchanted at the idea of going to the country, and childishly amused at the vain efforts of the 8 bridesmaids to discover where their mysterious retreat was situated. It was thought very English to have a country house lent to one, and the fact gave a last touch of distinction to what was generally conceded to be the most brilliant wedding of the year. But where the house was, no one was permitted to know, except the parents of bride and groom, who, when taxed with the knowledge, pursed their lips and said mysteriously, "H, they didn't tell us," which was manifestly true, since there was no need to. Once they were settled in their compartment, and the train, shaking off the endless wooden suburbs, had pushed out into the pale landscape of spring, talk became easier than Archer had expected. May was still, in look and tone, the simple girl of yesterday, eager to compare notes with him as to the incidents of the wedding, and discussing them as impartially as a bridesmaid talking it all over with an usher. At first Archer had fancied that this detachment was the disguise of an inward tremor, but her clear eyes revealed only the most tranquil unawareness. She was alone for the first time with her husband, but her husband, and was only the charming comrade of yesterday. There was no one whom she liked as much, no one whom she trusted as completely, and the culminating arc of the whole delightful adventure of engagement and marriage was to be off with him alone on a journey, like a grown-up person, like a married woman, in fact. It was wonderful that, as he had learned in the mission garden at St. Augustine, such depths of feeling could coexist with such absence of imagination. But he remembered how, even then, as he had surprised him, by dropping back to inexpressive girlishness, as soon as her conscience had been eased of its burden, and he saw that she would probably go through life dealing to the best of her ability with each experience as it came, but never anticipating any by so much as a stolen glance. Perhaps that faculty of unawareness was what gave her eyes their transparency, and her face the look of representing a type, rather than a person, as if she might have been chosen to pose for a civic virtue or a Greek goddess. The blood that ran so close to her fair skin might have been a preserving fluid, rather than a ravaging element, yet her look of indestructible youthfulness made her seem neither hard nor dull, but only primitive and pure. In the thick of this meditation, Archer suddenly felt himself looking at her with the startled gaze of a stranger, and plunged into a reminiscence of the wedding breakfast, and of Granny Mingott's immense and triumphant pervasion of it. May settled down to frank enjoyment of the subject. "I was surprised, though, weren't you? That Aunt Medora came after all. Ellen wrote that they were neither of them well enough to take the journey. I do wish it had been she who had recovered. Did you see the exquisite old lace she sent me?" He had known that the moment must come sooner or later, but he had somewhat imagined that by force of willing he might hold it at bay. "Yes, I know. Yes, it was beautiful," he said, looking at her blindly, and wondering if, whenever he heard those two syllables, all his carefully built-up world would tumble about him like a house of cards. "Aren't you tired? It will be good to have some tea when we arrive. I'm sure the aunts have got everything beautifully ready," he rattled on, taking her hand in his, and her mind rushed away instantly to the magnificent tea and coffee service of Baltimore silver which the Beauforts had sent, and which went so perfectly with Uncle Lovell Mingott's trays and citta dishes. In the spring twilight the train stopped at the Rinnebeck station, and they walked along the platform to the waiting carriage. "Ah, how awfully kind of the Van der Luydens, they've sent their man over from Skuytercliff to meet us," Archer exclaimed, as a sedate person out of livery approached them, and relieved the maid of her bags. "I'm extremely sorry, sir," said this emissary, "that a little accident has occurred at the Miss Dulac's. A leak in the water tank. It happened yesterday, and Mr. Van der Luyden, who heard of it this morning, sent a housemaid up by the early train to get the patroon's house ready. It will be quite comfortable, I think you'll find, sir, and the Miss Dulacs have sent their cook over, so that it will be exactly the same as if you'd been at Rinnebeck.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.